Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about... The Evatt Royal Commission is a fascinating case study in the interaction between public policy, public advocacy, and an attempt at disinterested inquiry. There were those inside and outside the government who supported the VVAA's claims, Vietnam's Veterans Association of Australia, I suppose it is, claims, and others who were openly sceptical. The major chemical companies, Dow, ICI, Monsanto, that's Imperial Chemical Industries, I think it is, naturally had a strong vested interest in the proceedings and instructed senior counsels accordingly. The final report was a massive document, 9 volumes, totaling 2,760 pages. Whatever the Royal Commissioner's original inclinations, and whatever those in government and who had set up the Commission had intended, the final report concluded that herbicides were not guilty of causing diseases and deformities alleged. The Ministers of Veteran Affairs declared that the government accepted the Commission's report but did not endorse its findings, and from that point on, it was on for young and old. As Peter Edwards, official historian of Australia's involvement in Southeast Asian conflicts in 1948-1975, observes, the problem was political rather than legal or scientific. A senior Labor Party official, Bob Hogg, was asked to review the report and, no doubt to the disappointment of his son, endorsed the report's findings while recommending the establishment of a continuing morbidity study of Vietnam veterans, specifically endorsing Evatt's recommendations that repatriation benefits should be extended to cover circulatory disorders, alcoholism, and mental illness. The government again ignored the latter. One of the fundamental problems was that the VAAA sought to indict herbicides specifically as the source of the veterans' problems, and this was simply not sustainable on the basis of the evidence. They appeared as well to have seen the chemical companies as a readily source of financial compensation in keeping the philosophy behind American-style class actions. This, of course, required sustaining proof at law. Successive findings failed to meet the VVAA's demands served to fuel the conspiracy theories. Jean Williams, mother of one damaged veteran and well-known activist on Agent Orange and related issues, wrote in reference to the Minister for Veteran Affairs by Senator John Faulkner, that, like most politicians, he is often hog-tied by public servants who fail to come to grips with many veterans' health problems. It would generally be held that Senator Faulkner is perhaps the minister least likely to be misled by officials, but in her ardent indictment of herbicides, and all associated with them, Williams proved unable to distinguish between F.B. Barry Smith, the Australian historian and author of The Official History and Account of Herbicide Uses and Its Aftermath, and R.B. Ralph Smith, a British diplomatic historian who wrote extensively on quite unrelated aspects of the Vietnam War. Such advocacy was often characterised by passion rather than precision. Okay, well, this is unfortunate because an upset mum is going to make mistakes. That's what happens. Ultimately, the government accepted a limited range of links between herbicides and certain specific cancers in veterans. It did not accept the link with birth deformities and or, for cost reasons, one suspects a wide-ranging morbidity studies that would conclusively determine the exceptionalism or otherwise of Vietnam for service have never been undertaken. So the general myth is that Vietnam is an exception, but the reality is that Vietnam vets have moved themselves off. Successive governments over time have likewise refused to conduct similar studies into the older segment of the veteran population who survived Japanese captivity in World War II, and likely for the same reason, cost implications. Yes, so it is actually true. The prisoners of war suffered great health problems, like I personally know of this. In the case of Vietnam veterans, the eventual relaxation of rulings was driven by the US National Academy of Science report issued in 1994, which itself extrapolated from civilian cases of exposure to chemical toxins. It did not claim that links between herbicides and cancers did exist, but rather that there could be such links, In short, veterans were to be given the benefits of the doubt. The solution was essentially political, not scientific. Several things remain to be said on this issue. The initial studies of Vietnam veterans suggest that there was no excess health risk attributed to their service. And this view has been modified over the passage of time as more detailed longitudinal studies have been made possible. There's an inevitable, as part of a scientific process, is that evidence is neither for conspiracies nor hostility towards Vietnam veterans per se. As the authors of one such study made clear, quote, as this cohort ages, clearer patterns of disease may emerge. This latter study also concluded that while the incident of cancers among national servicemen who had served in Vietnam, quote, did not differ from the community rates, quote, it was high amongst national servicemen who served in Australia. In other words, world service was not a determining factor, not service in a Pacific war. This was in keeping with the general sense of repatriation legislation since the mid-1930s. Vietnam veterans were not a special case, but it could be argued that a special pleading on their behalf by some such as the VVAA actually retarded efforts to extend repatriation benefits to veterans, those veterans suffering health and readjustment issues in a manner common to the aftermath of all countries' wars. And this is so true for almost all these zombie myths, is that when they actually play out, they actually harm the thing that's motivating. One VAA's website declares that over the years, there have been persistent media presentation of Vietnam veterans as victims. The association believes that this is counterproductive. This is not an image VVAA wishes to perpetuate either for itself or its members. Rather, it sees Vietnam veterans as achievers. Vietnam veterans have reached the highest level of business, professional, and political ranks within Australia. And every one of them has overcome psychological health problems in order to raise a family and live relatively normal lives, has overcome adversity in order to achieve. Vietnam veterans aren't victims, they are achievers. Exactly so. The image of Vietnam veterans as capable citizens making a worthwhile contribution to society, having fought for its country, or his or her country, when called upon, has been undermined by the existence of the veteran wannabes, individuals who, for whatever reason, pass themselves off as something they're not. Former members of the armed forces, usually decorated, who were deployed in Vietnam. In some cases, the motivation is fraud through exploiting the repatriation system. Many others create elaborate personas for themselves to answer some psychological need, and all deserve to be exposed to what they are, liars, cheats, thieves, of other men's honours. The phenomenon has equivalents after earlier wars, and not only in Australia. Several of those who claim to be the last Confederate veteran of the American Civil War have since been exposed as fraud. There are document cases of fake winners of the Victorian Cross after World War I attempting to use their status for financial gain, while fraud on the repatriation system in 1960 was allegedly so widespread that it spawned an expose of the issue. It is a federal offence to claim a returned serviceman liable for 6 months' imprisonment and $3,300 in fines, though few prosecutions have been launched. More importantly, the ridiculous stories of the fantasies, which naturally emphasise their own valour, suffering, and allegedly highly classified nature of their exploits, serve to feed the negative stereotypes of Vietnam veterans as emotionally unstable time bombs. All attracts their share of myth and misunderstanding. That is one of the premises on which this book is based. Few wars in modern times have attracted such accretion of myth, misbelief, and arrant nonsense as attached to itself in the Vietnam War. It's hard to say. You basically, to join the RSL, you have to. You can only join if it's approved by Central Army Records. So there's got to be an official record for you to be in the RSL. So I don't think RSL has a problem, but. Yeah, so you need a letter from Caro's records specifying your units of service to be forwarded to the RSL branch, and then they let you in. It's quite simple, it doesn't have to be that complex, but I can't see. The VAA obviously has a problem. It hasn't got a good system. War is a divisive and unpopular, although never in Australia has polarising as in the United States. Contrary to the old line that the victors write the history, in fact, Vietnam is concerned the dominant image and received reasons have been fashioned by the losers. That's true. America lost and they fashioned it. America's popular culture is so pervasive, especially the English-speaking world, that our memories of war are shaped and coloured by American responses to the American experience. Those responses often have little to do with the way in which American soldiers actually fought the experienced war and experienced war. They have even less to say to Australians. Our understanding of Vietnam also displays a strong ahistorical tendency. That's quote-unquote ahistorical. The experiences of soldiers and the aftermath of their service was consistent with the experiences of earlier generations who also struggled against incomprehension, indifference, and fiscal parsimony when they sought to press claims for rightful compensation for industries related to active service. The attempts to claim unique status of Vietnam experience and to place responsibility for whatever ailments inflicted on veterans on a single source, chemical herbicides, arguably make the fight for understanding and comprehension harder than it need be. With concomitant distress and disadvantage to some veterans, a vulnerable stage in their lives, the presentation of veterans as victims is a key part of this. The image will linger longer after the community has recognized the very different reality. So, it's Every War Part 1, Myth, History, and Vietnam. That's a complicated thing to say because really this is myth making gone wrong, because there's money involved in it, and there's an American popularization of the Vietnam War, and yes, I suppose it's very real for me, speaking with or training with the veterans. But this is the entire thing of this single view, and we have the Invictus Games, which is the Australian version, or the Allied version, Australia, India, various, Canada, America, Invictus Games, people who are wounded and fight through, and it's Afghanistan, various things like that, a post-traumatic stress disorder. It's one of these things that, it's a horrible thing to go through, war, I think, in general, but this is a myth. It's a sort of a really messy myth. The other myths are just downright embarrassing or misinformed. It's okay to be embarrassed and misinformed. It's just the next section of your belief system which goes with that, which allows you to censure other people. And sort of it's the hostile aspect of these myths. And ultimately, the myths are counterproductive to the various people. So, in almost every myth, there is an opportunity lost. That the myth creates a sense of the status quo. The status quo needs to move forward, and the myth is holding us back. Thanks a lot for listening. Zombie Myths of Australian Military History, edited by Craig Stockings. We're formally going from the 90% almost up to the 100%, let's call it 98% because of the 2% epilogue going here. And this is chapter 10, The Tales, Two Tales of Timor. So Timor is a Portuguese island. It's in the archipelago of Indonesia, sitting slap bang in the middle of it. And basically, Portugal swapped and ceded to the, at various stages, the Portuguese, then the Spanish, then the Dutch and French and English and all these people came along. But so Portugal was sort of a speck in the Spice Isles, and it was garrisoned. Portugal expanded so quickly and had various disasters beset it that it ran out of people, and so it garrisoned its little fort in Timor, this Timor-Leste, so they're Portuguese-speaking people, and their racial origin is a mix between the black African conscript soldiers they had there and the Japanese. Very interesting culture, very Catholic culture in a Muslim world. And so Timor was invaded in 1975 and then liberated or got freedom as one of the world's youngest and poorest nations. Australia has been sort of a questionable brother to it. So, tale of two Timors, Clinton Ferdinand's. Australia's conducted two military interventions in East Timor during the 20th century. So there's an island of Timor and it's divided east and west. And so the right-hand side is east. And so it's there plus a little exclusion zone of land up the top. It's hard to understand it. The first intervention in December 1941 is widely assumed to have been made in order to expel Japanese forces from the territory. In fact, Japan had no forces in Portuguese East Timor, as Australian policy makers knew at the time. What's more, Japan had no intention of deploying forces in East Timor, Portuguese Timor, which is a colony of Portugal, a neutral power in World War II. In its march through Asia, Japan had refrained from violating the neutrality of other Portuguese colonies of Macau. It was only after the Australian, Dutch and British troops had deployed in Portuguese East Timor and violated Portuguese neutrality that Japan decided to send its own forces there.
Whack-o.
Look at that. The second intervention came in December 1999. And since has been reconstructed as a remarkable example of the Australian government exercising so-called responsibility to protect the people of East Timor. In truth, the government worked assiduously to prevent international intervention into East Timor until the bitter end. This chapter will examine both interventions, quoting extensively from declassified and leaked internal documents. Let the actual words of the policymakers speak for themselves. So this is a big thing. I thought the Japanese invaded East Timor. No, we invaded it, and they kicked us out. East Timor is the eastern half of the island of Timor and includes an enclave of Okasu and Tembo, located in West Timor. This is a little enclave. And the small islands of Alto and Jaco at just under 15,000 square kilometres, it's about the size of Northern Ireland or the US state of Connecticut. Human settlement in East Timor is thousands of years old. Portuguese imperial control of the territory began early in the 16th century, although as late as the mid-19th century, the colonial presence was limited to a few tiny settlements on the northern coast. During this colonial period, the Portuguese exploited rivalry amongst various groups, ensuring indigenous political alliances remained weak and a sense of national identity remained undeveloped. For their part, the Dutch had taken possession of the west half of Timor early in the 17th century. There was a period of consternation between Dutch and Portuguese on the island until the treaties of 1816 and 1893 to establish firm Portuguese sovereignty over the eastern half. Final territorial agreements between the Dutch and the Portuguese came into effect in 1914. For much of the 20th century, Portugal itself was under the rule of Salazar dictatorship, which banned strikes, lockouts and political parties. The regime used censorship and propaganda. This is hard to believe that Portuguese, a European country, was just as despotic. It's a real despotic. It's quite unnerving to read about. The regime use of censorship, propaganda and political imprisonment to neutralise society, while according to special privileges to the church in areas of law and education. Portuguese rule inside East Timor reflected this relationship between church and state. It's also worth noting that throughout the period of Portuguese colonial control, Portugal and Britain had one of the oldest continuous political alliances, the ancient Anglo-Portuguese Treaty of 1373.
So these old treaties, right, came like zombies to life to get Britain into war
and referred on the 9th of May, 1386, as the Treaty of Windsor. Although it had enjoyed the status of a formal permanent alliance when signed in the 14th century, the treaty had fallen into a state of neglect until Britain invoked it during World War II to obtain use of the Portuguese bases in the Azores, the archipelago, of 9 wildly separated islands in the Mid-Atlantic. Portugal presented but remained neutral during the war. Okay, so perhaps there's this ancient treaty. It's really interesting. Australia had not shown any serious interest in Portuguese Timor before World War II. Very few successful Australian businesses had been established there. And trade links were almost non-existent. There had been a suggestion during World War I that Australia should take possession of Portuguese Timor as a summer holiday location for northern Australians. Prime Minister Andrew Fisher had expressed some interest in the idea, but was soon rejected because, as Secretary of the Australian Department of External Affairs, Atlee Hunt, said, if the residents of the north can afford to go away to escape the summer, it is far more likely they'll come south, where they can have the advantages of society and their friends and relatives can go to such places as Timor. Nor in the decades that followed did Portuguese Timor feature much on the consciousness of Australian policymakers, except on those occasions when rumours circulated that one foreign power or another was contemplating buying it from the Portuguese. A Dutch newspaper, for example, reported in 1932 that Japan intended to purchase new Timor from Portuguese. The Portuguese government immediately contacted the Australian officials and assured them that there was not the slightest foundation of this report in question. Nonetheless, there continued to be rumours from time to time, these continued denied by Portugal. After the outbreak of World War II, Australian authorities became concerned that some Japanese businesses had established in Portuguese Timor, which might well be used as a pretext for military intervention in the territory. However, although Japan had framed its rhetoric as anti-colonial terms, it had no intention of deploying forces in East Timor. Even during the rapid advance through Asia at the early stages of the Pacific War, Japanese military planners never included Portuguese Timor or Portugal's other colony, Macau, on their list of war objectives. The Australian government, on the other hand, was interested in establishing a presence in the territory. An air link was set up between Darwin and Dili, the capital of Portuguese Timor, as a regular stopping place on the Darwin to Singapore route, and as a rudimentary intelligence collection program for the territory was initiated. Mr. David Ross was posted as the Civilian Aviation Department's representative in Dili in February 41, in order to administer the Qantas Empire Airways, his official role, and report on any Japanese activities, his unofficial role. Ross's position made him, quote, very diffident about discussing political questions with the governor of Portuguese Timor, as he felt he had no status for doing so. Ross soon reported that I have far overstepped my functions as so far as the Portuguese authorities are concerned. The facts of Australia's subsequent intervention into Portuguese Timor in 1941 are as follows. After the attack on Pearl Harbour on the 7th of December 1941, British authorities, so Pearl Harbour, within February the 14th, Singapore falls, the British authorities requested that Australia send troops to Portuguese Timor, claiming that Portugal had agreed to the plan. The Australian government had very limited resources at the time, but nonetheless agreed to Britain's request, while emphasising the importance of the Portuguese government publicly approving the mission. Once assured by Britain that all arrangements were in place, Australia ordered the forces to land in Portuguese Timor, despite the fact that Portuguese authorities had not given their approval. Well, this is bloody POMS. And while Australian forces were in the process of deploying, the Portuguese government expressed public hostility to the operation. Suddenly, they're concerned about the blowback of the mission. British officials requested Australians not mention that Britain was in any way associated with the operation, even though the plan was primarily a British one. Although annoyed at being placed in a difficult position, the Australians complied. The British government then proceeded to express its regret to Portugal about the actions of Allied military authorities on the spot, implying that it had not involved in the entire operation as a result of the decision made by lower-level tactical commanders in Australia and the Netherlands. These are the facts of history, and the evidence is outlined below. On the 12th of December 1941, the Australian Prime Minister John Curtin received a cable from Lord Cranbourne, Britain's Secretary of State of Dominion Affairs. Cranbourne advised Curtin that the Dutch had agreed to participate in an attack on Japanese forces in Portuguese Timor. He said December 41? They hadn't actually... I don't understand. How did they get there? I'm just confused. Because how did they get there? He said that the governor of the territory was being advised that the governor of Portugal to facilitate the task of the Dutch and Australian forces would be landing in Portuguese Timor. Auckland and Cranbourne urged Curtin to send a very small token of forces of Australians to supplement the Dutch troops to be used. The Australian contribution, Cranberry stated, was of considerable importance. He requested a favourable response at the earliest possible moment. Curtin cabled back the same day, noting that the Australian government had agreed and was authorising Lieutenant Colonel Bill Leggett, the Australian commander of West Timor, to send a detachment to act as a connection with the Dutch in order to liquidate the Japanese. Curtin advised that the move should be made without delay. I don't quite understand this, because the Japanese weren't in Timor until, you know, 42, so I don't understand it. Next day, Cranberry informed Curtin, so this means that my understanding's all garbled. Sorry, guys, I'm ready to listen and I'm confused. Next day, Cranberry informed Curtin that the Portuguese government had agreed to accept assistance in the event of a Japanese attack against the Portuguese Timor. The Portuguese government had instructed the governor, M. D. de Chava, to make contact with the counterpart in the West Timor, Dutch resident F. J. Nobia. So West Timor is Dutch, right? And or so we have sent people to Dutch Timor. I don't understand this. As about its common interests, which are immediate application, Canberra advised that the British had informed the Portuguese that Allied forces in the region should be given a wide latitude because the Japanese might attack at any moment. The other problem, of course, was that there has not been a Japanese attack against Portuguese Timor, nor was there any evidence of the Japanese intention to mount such an attack. It was hardly likely the government of Portuguese Timor would be agreeable to the intrusion of Allied troops when the Japanese had thus far been so scrupulous in respecting Portuguese neutrality. Despite this, the Australian government advised Cranberry that there has been a consultation with the government of Portugal's Timor at 7 a.m. 17th of September, 2 hours of which a combined force of Dutch and Australians travelling by sea would land in Dili. This consultation was, of course, merely to provide a facade of having obtained Portuguese consent. Conscious that such a meeting would no doubt be recognised as no more than a perfunctory gesture, Cranberry replied that, if possible, a rather longer interval should be allowed to elapse between the time that the conference at Dili begins and the time when the combined force arrives. The Australian government agreed and informed David Ross, how now the consul at Dili, accordingly. Ross, in turn, advised Lieutenant Colonel Leggett and the commanding officer of the Dutch forces in Timor, Lieutenant Colonel Deke. Immediately after that, however, Cranberry informed Curtin the reaction of the Portuguese Secretary General, Dr. L. Teixeira de Sampo, to the operation had been violently unfavourable. Cranberry urgently requested Curtin to ensure the Australian forces made every effort to reach agreement with the government of Portuguese Timor before landing was attempted. Then Lieutenant Colonels Leggett and Digger met Mr. M. de La Feira de Carvalho, governor of the Portuguese Timor, and advised him in writing of his opposition to the landing of foreign troops. Now let me read this book. His letter. In reply to the communique which you gentlemen handed me at 9:20 a.m. today, requesting me to accept the help of the Australian Dutch forces, which will be directed immediately to the territory of this colony, I have the honour to inform you that in accordance with the instructions of the government of Portugal, I cannot accept this help, because this position with regard to the conflict is one of strict neutrality, and because no aggression of any sort has taken place in our territory, the last mentioned being the sole condition on which the government of Portugal could accept the Australian Dutch forces for the defence of the colony. Under the circumstances, every disembarkation force will be considered as a breach of neutrality of our territory. The landing, however, went ahead. De Ferreira cabled Curtin in similarly ambiguous terms. The governor of the Portuguese Timor protested vigorously against the aggression, absolutely contrary to the principles of law being carried out against this by the Portuguese territory by Dutch Australian forces, who claimed to be acting in accordance with the instructions received from the government of the Netherlands Indies, in agreement with the government of the Commonwealth of Australia. So this is just appalling war crimes. This is awful. The Australian government then attempted to portray the intervention as being necessary to defend Portuguese Timor against Japanese aggression. Something that had not occurred in the territory. It asked David Ross to convey the following message to the governor of Portuguese Timor. In reply to your communication, Commonwealth government rejects that in order to defend against Japanese aggression, it has been found necessary to prevent Japanese breach of neutrality of Timor, which they have done. We assure you Portuguese sovereignty will not be impaired, and in fact it is to defend sovereignty as well as to prevent Japanese aggression that our forces have cooperated with the Netherlands government in taking action. Commonwealth government desires to assist in every way possible regarding the administration and economic life of the colony. and embarrassed Campbell, then a former Curtin, that the Portuguese government would in no circumstances consent to Allied troops entering the territory unless the enemy attack had actually been made. He tried to minimise his own part in the affair by telling the Portuguese government that Japanese submarine activity or Portuguese turmoil had created an unavoidable necessity. Campbell apologised to the Portuguese for the Allies' actions, implying that lower-level tactical commanders of Australia and the Netherlands had acted hastily. The Dutch troop provided Portugal with an official statement of regret, arguing that the landings were necessary in the view of the Japanese submarine activity of Timor.
Of course,
An angry John Curtin agreed with the standing British request to maintain silence as far as the British involvement in the affair was concerned, but laid out the entire sequence of events in a detailed cable to Lord Campbell in order to ensure that the historical record was preserved. On the 11th of December 1941, he reminded Campbell, "You indicated the UK's desire for Australia to provide a very small token force with the main Dutch force in order to ensure a defence of Portuguese Timor against Japanese aggression or infiltration. Tuesday later," he said, "you told us that Portugal had agreed to the plan. Therefore, despite our very limited resources," Curtin continued, "we agreed to your request because the Australian government had impressed upon Campbell the desirability of having Portuguese government give public support to their operation. It was at Campbell's request," Curtin continued, "that we engaged, we changed the timing so that the landings would occur more than 2 hours after the Portuguese government had been formally consulted. But it was only after the expedition had set out that we heard from you that the Portuguese government had suddenly become hostile and lost its nerve." Curtin reminded Campbell that he would not mention Britain's association with the operation, although the plan was primarily yours. Accordingly, the governor of Portuguese Timor protested to Curtin directly. The Prime Minister made no public statement whatsoever. Furthermore, in difficult circumstances, and solely in order to meet your position, he made no reference whatsoever to your part of the enterprise. On the ground, a combined force of 155 Australians and 260 troops had landed near Dili on the 17th of December 1914. But, as Curtin informed Campbell, the position was most unsatisfactory because the governor of Portuguese Timor, far from going along with the charade, has in fact organising troops to harass our troops and will certainly assist the Japanese, any Japanese landing. To add to this tense situation, the Dutch field commander, Lieutenant Colonel N.W. van Straten, was awaiting instructions from the Dutch headquarters authorising him to take full military control and disarm the Portuguese. Curtin rejected Campbell's suggestion that all Dutch forces in Portuguese Timor be replaced with Australian forces because he said, "Our limited forces and our wild commitments make the plan impractical." Curtin said that Australia's view, "Portugal should have been frankly informed at the beginning, and in your opinion, the occupation was based upon military necessity that Japanese infiltration or invasion could not otherwise be prevented. The facts of history are clear, even though the myth persists that Australia sent troops to Portuguese Timor in order to expel Japanese forces." That is what we were told. That's what we're told. This is just complete horrible. Persistence of this myth may be attributed to a combination of ignorance, innocence, and benevolent national self-image, and subsequent portrayals of Australian troops fighting heroically alongside the people of East Timor against Japanese when they did, in fact, eventually land on the 19th of February 1942. So that's 5 days after Singapore falls, and 5 days they're in there. "For the people of East Timor, the cost of the ensuing conflict was ensured, 40,000 to 60,000 people dying as a result." So that's more than the Australians lost in the Japanese prisoner of war camps, I believe. "The people of East Timor never received war repatriation for their sufferings in this conflict from either Japan, whose forces caused such devastation, or from the Allies whose actions drew the Japanese into Timor in the first place. 3 decades later, in 75, Indonesia invaded East Timor and occupied it for the next 24 years, with a diplomatic and material support from Western states, such including Australia. Approximately 200,000 East Timorese died from unnatural causes as a result of the invasion and occupation. This figure represents perhaps the highest death toll relative to population since the Holocaust. Successive Australian governments provided consistent diplomat and other forms of support to the ongoing Indonesian occupations." So, can I say, Indonesians are just frankly terrifying. Good God. In September 1999, however, the Australian government took the lead in assembling a multinational peacekeeping force to guarantee Timor's independence. This intervention has given rise to another myth that the Australian government was exercising its so-called responsibility to protect the people of East Timor. Although the intervention did in fact lead to the independence of East Timor, in fact, is that the killings ended as a result of non-Australian diplomatic pressures, as a US threat to withdraw military and other assistance from Indonesia, and refusal by other Western governments to continue to support the Indonesian military occupation of East Timor.
So they had the Indonesian military are just breathtaking, but they're slightly different. They're slightly different trained in a different way. They're terrifying. Whatever the merits or otherwise, the responsibility to protect document, the East Timor case cannot be used to invoke it, except by ignoring the historical record. In order to understand the dynamics of the 1999 intervention, the temptation to quote the Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Dander is irresistible. Emerging from a meeting in March 1999, the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said, "We hope there won't be a need for a peacekeeping force, because if you need a peacekeeping force, you need a peace to keep. And the peace first has to be negotiated, and we hope that when the peace is negotiated, it will be a peaceful peace that won't require a peacekeeping force." Such was the official attitude to humanitarian intervention in East Timor at the time, in February 1999, soon after the Indonesian President J.B. Habibie announced that the East Timorese people would be allowed to vote in a ballot on independence. His foreign affairs advisor, Duit Fontana Anwar, sounded a public warning about Indonesian military's forthcoming campaign of military-backed terror. Writing in the International Herald Tribune, she said Indonesia's half a million strong military cannot be relied on to do the job of providing security for the ballot because it's not regarded as neutral. Alarmed by this public warning, the US Assistant General Secretary of State for East Asia, Stanley Roth, met the Secretary of State for Australia's Foreign Affairs and Trade, Ashton Calvert, 5 days later in Washington, D.C. According to a highly sensitive manuscript of the conversation, Roth was of the view that a full-scale peacekeeping operation would be unavoidable in its aspect of the transition. Australia's position of keeping peace, keeping at arm's length, was essentially defeatist, and that it was necessary to go forth and persuade Congress and UN member states that it simply had to be done. Pick up reading after a break. There's Roth from the United States, and that he said that you really needed a full-scale peacekeeping troops because they've had half a century of basic religious and ethnic cleansing. So ethnically, the East Timorese are a mixture of black Africans in that area and Catholic, and you had a Muslim racial cleansing of this place. So the Indonesians army, who'd been doing all the massacres, couldn't actually run the election. But we see what Roth says, and I say it again, a full-scale peacekeeping operation would be an unavoidable aspect of the transition. Australia's position of keeping peace, peacekeeping at arm's length was essentially defeatist, and it was necessary to go forth and persuade Congress and the UN member states that it simply had to be done. Calvert was stating the Australian government's clear position that it would not support peacekeepers. It's important to understand that the transcript of the Calvert-Roth meeting was leaked to the media soon after. Had it not been made public, the Australian people would not have found out about the government's secret rejection of Roth's proposal until 2029, when the archives would have been opened up under the 30-year rule. By contrast, real-time leak resulted in a swift escalation of political pressure on the Australian government. 3 weeks later, a number of Timorese militiamen went to Liqua village, accompanied by Indonesian armed police personnel. They surrounded a church where villagers were sheltering, dragged two priests out of the church compound and took them to a local military district headquarters. One of the priests was removed. Indonesian troops began to throw tear gas into the church. When the refugees ran out, blinded and trying to save themselves, the militia rushed towards them. Women and children were attacked with fists,
6 rifle butts, stones, arrows, and machetes. 86 people were killed and 7 injured during this attack. Afterwards, the militia forced the local people to hoist the Indonesian national flag. So, Indonesia wanted to keep this, and so they, after this, the massacre could have been used to apply international pressure on Indonesian authorities to permit international peace use. Instead, the Australian government moved into damage control mode, commenting on the massacre. Foreign Minister Downer said, quote, the Indonesian military were present. Well, look, the Indian military were present, I understand, at the incident, but there again, there's a debate about what part they played. They clearly didn't themselves kill people, but there is an argument about whether they did try to stop the fighting or they didn't do enough to try to stop the fighting. And the trouble is, it's very hard, given we ourselves had no eyewitnesses there, to be able to prove this case either way. Dowler's statement absolving the Indonesian military was, however, followed by a well-timed leak of classified intelligence material that differed spectacularly from his assurances. The Defence Intelligence Organisation's preliminary assessment of the massacre was contained in its current intelligence brief of 8th of April 1999. So the ABRI, the Armed Forces of the Republic of Indonesia, so ABRI, had fired tear gas into the church and apparently did not intervene when pro-independence activists attacked Brimod. Police Mobile Brigade were allegedly standing behind the attack at the church and firing into the air. ABRI is culpable whether it actively took part in the violence or simply let it occur. The combination of leaked intelligence material increased public visibility of the events of East Timor. In addition, the outspoken advocacy of armed international presence on the ground by the Australian Labor Party's Foreign Affairs spokesman, Laurie Brereton, had severely detrimental effect on Downer's credibility. So, at least we've got sort of moving a different phase. This is a myth, one of these horrible myths, self-destructing. In June 1999, the US military Hawaii-based Pacific Command raised the possibility of attaching Australian military officers to a possible US police enforcement operation in East Timor. The US recruits spoke of using overwhelming force to stop killing and was conveyed to the commander, Australian Theatre Air Vice Marshal Robert Treloar. Since Treloar commanded the headquarters that would overseas and deployment of troops in East Timor, the US military was deliberately addressing the Australian Defence Force, ADF, officer best placed to advise the government that the proposal was feasible. Treloar undertook to refer the request to senior levels of the Australian government. The request was declined after lengthy top-level consideration. When asked about such a request during question time in Parliament, Downer initially claimed that he had neither seen the cable nor knew of the request, although he was an addressee, as were the Prime Minister, Minister of Defence, and heads of the respective departments. Downer assured the House that he was completely aware of any proposal by the United States, unaware of any proposal by the United States for, to mount a peace enforcement. This is us in East Timor. Now, the problem is that you can't tell a lie to Parliament. So if you tell a lie to Parliament, you get kicked out. That's a simple. So it could be you could say what's 1 + 1, and you say 3, and you, not a mistake, it's a lie, you get kicked out. A diplomatic cable containing a copy of the request was leaked to members of the press. Late that night, the government learnt that early editions of the next day's Age newspaper were carrying detailed excerpts of the cable. Downer rushed back to Parliament at 11:32 p.m. and made a clarification saying that apparently the issue was informally raised by officials who asked hypothetically about peace enforcement, but he continued that it was not a formal United States government request. It was Downer's third forced clarification since becoming Foreign Minister. The Australian government also refused to direct a US request to hand over intelligence material detailing links between the Indonesian Armed Forces and the pro-Jakarta militias in East Timor. The requests were made on several occasions to the Australian Ambassador in Jakarta, John McCarthy, and to Australia's Ambassador in the US, Andrew Peacock. Both envoys refused to make information available. The Australian intelligence liaison officer to the US, Merv Jenkins, was, however, required to exchange intelligence as part of the normal duties. and the US intelligence community was particularly interested in the material that tied the Indonesian military to the militias. When Jenkins passed on such intelligence to the US counterparts, he was placed under heavy pressure by the Australian authorities, who flew to the US, interrogated him, and threatened him with prosecution and imprisonment. Jenkins committed suicide following the treatment. That's a shocking thing. Sorry. You can see the seediness that we hear out in Australia and Judy. This is just the most seedy, horrible, horrible things. A senior officer of the US Embassy in Canberra subsequently contacted Brereton's policymaker, Dr. Philip Dorling, to convey his concern to the United States intelligence that, notwithstanding public statements to the contrary, the Australian government had withheld or otherwise delayed the sharing of US important intelligence material relating to Indonesian military and militia activities. Against such a backdrop, Hugh White, Deputy Secretary of Strategy to the Australian Department of Defence, appeared before the Parliamentary Committee in June 1999 and made the following statement about the Indonesian military. I think it would be fair to say that the ABRI, now TNI, whatever that means, the Republic of Indonesia, or what that used to be, and TNI, I don't know, the Timor militia, has taken in some ways quite remarkable steps of welcoming, viewing the Indonesian political situation as a whole, a politically neutral and constructive partner with other elements of the Indonesian society seeking to genuinely reform the Indonesian political structure. Whatever that means. In July, the Australian Prime Minister John Howard visited the US, publicly praised the Indonesian government and urged the US to be more understanding of it, as he put it. We remain very much in the view the Indonesian government deserves a great deal of credit for two things. Firstly, for the steps it's taken to embrace democracy in Indonesia as a whole, which is quite a historical development, and to the commitment to hold an open ballot. I said that Indonesia deserves from the world perhaps a little more credit and a little more praise and understanding. These public statements, who said this? John Howard, my God, he's an idiot. The public statements send a clear signal of support to Indonesian authorities. The actual barrel for independence of Indonesia was held on the 30th of August 1999. Despite the climate of fear, the campaign of intimidation, the presence of dubious voters from West Timor, in fact, was that many voters did not believe their votes were secret. And the fact, 78.5% of registered voters opted for independence from Indonesia. The result was that day, the 4th of September 1999, the Indonesian military began a campaign of forced displacement, driving approximately 250,000 East Timorese across the border of West Timor, according to the United Nations subsequent investigation by Indonesia's National Human Rights Commission. Approximately 70% of the buildings in East Timor, now officially the Democratic Republic of Timor-Est, were destroyed. Vital infrastructure was crippled. The towns across East Timor were left without running water, electricity, and telephones. Indonesia's foreign minister, an officer of order of Australia, Ali Atalas, issued ambiguous warning. Any nations willing to send peacekeepers to the province would have to shoot their way in. The Australian Defence Planters implemented Operation Spitfire, which involved a military escort from the UN compound to Dili Airport, and then a one-way trip out of East Timor. The excavation of UN staff, journalists, foreign observers, and a few East Timorese would allow Indonesia to act without foreign witnesses, permitting it to manoeuvre without restrictions, reverse the results of the ballot, and retain East Timor. On the 5th of September 1999, while the burning of Dili was underway, Dana said, quote, I get the impression that President Habibie and Mr. Atlas, General Ruto, are all trying to do the right thing, and some of the commanders are clearly trying to do the right thing. Oh, God, this is sickening. I think Australians should read this. The immediate US reaction to the ensuing ethnic cleansing campaign, informed by its stance of Australia's ally, was that it was not contemplating military intervention. It signalled to the Indonesians that there would not be any meaningful US opposition to the actions in East Timor, although they would need to act quickly to take the heat out of the issue. The US ambassador to Indonesia, Stapleton Roy, met President Habibie, but denied the armed peacekeepers had been discussed. That was not the purpose of our discussion. It was to explore any ideas that could be helpful. We were not there to make a proposal for armed peacekeepers. We were there to explore how to assist Indonesia in its responsibility to maintain good security environments and how the international community could be more helpful. At a regular Pentagon briefing on the 7th September 1999, Defence spokesman Kenneth Bacon talked about the regrettable, unfortunate problems in East Timor. Ethnic cleansing. This is just an island off Australia. There's a bit of a... There's the continental shelf drips and Indonesia begins problem here, so it's off Australia's continental shelf, but not by much. He said that the US position was clear. We're going to continue to encourage Indonesian authorities to provide security. Second, we're going to await the report of the UN survey team, and when we have that information in hand, we'll decide what to do. National Security Advisor Santi Berger also signaled the Indonesians that although they had to wind up operations quickly, the US would not intervene. My daughter has a very messy apartment up in College, Berger stated. Maybe I shouldn't intervene and have it cleaned up. I don't think anybody ever articulated a doctrine which said that we ought to intervene wherever there's humanitarian problems. Over this stage, however, the public outrage in Australia and internationally was reaching tsunami-like proportions. The Howard government, now with no viable political alternative, finally reversed the policy and asked for international assistance to convince Indonesian military to stop the killings. But still, while Australian politicians vacillated, others acted. Portugal's Prime Minister, Antonio Guterres, telephoned President Clinton saying the Portuguese troops would be pulled out of Kosovo if a peacekeeping force were not deployed in East Timor. Portugal then prevented 16 military flights from departing its airbase in the Azores. The US strategic planners, however, the most significant pressure was the US Congress, where many senators and representatives were urging immediate action. All the years of lobbying undertaken by the US activists were paying off. Pro-East Timor members of Congress were able to harness the support of a majority of their fellow congressmen. U.S. Senators Leahy and Feingold proposed legislation to bar continuing U.S. finance of Indonesia. In response, U.S. strategists reacted swiftly. As a senior official said, we don't have a dog running in East Timor race, but we have a very big dog running down called Australia, and we have to support it. The main concern was to terminate Indonesian military operations. Once that was accomplished, the peacekeeping force could still be required to prevent further loss of life. But an Australian force would be able to cope. The US ensured that its message to Indonesian military was delivered in person. Admiral Dennis Blair, Commander-in-Chief of the US Forces in the Pacific, met General Rianto in Jakarta on the 8th September 1999, informing him that the military ties were being suspended. U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen threatened that there would be, quote, serious economic consequences if the killing in Timor continued. State Department spokesman James Rubin warned Indonesia's relations with the international community, including the United States, are at risk here. The chairman of the Chiefs of Staff, General Hugh Shelton, telephoned Ranton several times during the week after the announcement of the referendum result. Jakarta remained adamant past the first deadline, triggering a suspension of all U.S. military assistance. President Clinton publicly warned, if Indonesia does not end the violence, it must invite the international community to assist in restoring security. It would be a pity if the Indonesian recovery were crashed by this. In an emergency debate, the U.N. Security Council, on the 12th of September 1999, the U.S. envoy, Richard Holbrooke, finally warned Indonesia that it faced a point of no return in international relations if it did not accept international peacekeeping force. Against such rapid and overwhelming U.S. diplomatic pressure, Indonesia's military system ended within hours. On the 12th of September 1999, Habibie and Rianto emerged from a special cabinet meeting. Before the television cameras and microphones of the assembled international media, Habibie announced that his government had decided to allow U.N. force into East Timor. Rianto's presence, besides Habibie, sent a clear message that the TNI had agreed to support the decision. So I think TNI is the military. Telling the Australian strategic plan is initially named the peace. Keeping point, IFET, International Force East Timor. They were soon told that IFET already existed. It was the International Federation of East Timor, a global coalition of activists who campaigned for East Timor's self-determination for years. Even at the very end, Australian policymakers were unaware of the powerful forces that had propelled them into a policy reversal. Now, they renamed the force Interfet. After the intervention, the Australian government moved quickly to rewrite the historical record by commissioning a book that painted itself as the best possible light. Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade subsequently published East Timor Transition 98 to 2000, Australian Policy Challenge in 2001, purporting a full balanced account of Australian response to extraordinary foreign policy challenge in East Timor. The book launched by the Foreign Minister, Alexander Dander, who said it was aimed to set the record straight. For a number of reasons, this pronouncement should not be treated as if it represented a credible analysis of contemporary history. Most importantly, this is the Australian government. Oh, gosh. Can you understand why us Aussies are so fed up and upset with this simmering level of corruption here? This is just an excusal. Now, for a number of reasons, this pronouncement should not be... let's see. In other words, it's those who implemented the policies were asserting their own performances within the covers of the book. They had symbols written using materials they had themselves selected. It therefore comes at no surprise the book offers no serious examination of one of the most important episodes of Australian foreign policy. Among the reasons for the persistence of the second myth is that the Australian public has never been fond of authoritarian regime of the Indonesian President Suharto. Public disapproval in Australia was consolidated by 1991 Santa Cruz massacre, as well as the efforts of human rights activists who continued to highlight abuses of the Indonesian military to cite the irritation of both the Australian, Indonesian and Australian governments. When troops were finally sent, a segment of Australian style took the view that Australia was standing up for Indonesian, standing up to the Indonesians and liberating East Timorese at the same time. Since both causes were popular, and since it all worked out in the end, there was little public pressure to ask why matters had come to a head. A successful military appointment, after all, does not produce calls to examine what went wrong, since nothing apparently did go wrong. But whether the myths continue or not, the historical evidence is clear. That is a fantastic... Yeah, this is... What a blow. So I didn't know... Australia was just so evil. So I have to apologise for that. And that's just recent. Gee whiz, it's a big thing. There's only one more part of the book, which is the epilogue to go. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.